Hey, y'all, it's Melissa Harris-Perry with you here on The Takeaway, and it's good to have you along with us. Take a listen to something with me.
It's admitted in the Times, New York Times reports, or Time Magazine, that a recent survey shows that racism is broader and stronger than before. We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing. But one thing I'm sure of, this is no time to stop.
These are the words of the Supreme Court's first Black justice, Thurgood Marshall, as he accepted the Jurist of the 20th Century Award from the National Bar Association. The year was 1988. Nearly a half century earlier, in 1940, Marshall had founded the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. The storied civil rights organization has only had seven presidents. And like its founder, its current leader, Sherrilyn Ifill, is a civil rights superhero. So it was a bit of a surprise when Ifill recently announced that she would be stepping down from the helm of LDF. After all, this is a moment that could be described as Marshall characterized 1988.
We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing.
But again, to quote Marshall, this is no time to stop. Enter the LDS, soon to be 8th president.
My name is Janae Nelson. I'm the Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
And as she gets ready to assume the role of leading the NAACP LDF, I asked Janae about the lessons she'll take from her predecessor, Sherrilyn Ifill, and the direction she hopes to build. Let me say congratulations. I know that you're going to be assuming the leadership of NAACP LDF as the 8th president coming up in the spring. And it's just wonderful news for all of us who have followed your career.
Thank you. I'm extremely excited and deeply honored.
Now, Sherrilyn Ifill is, those are some big shoes to fill, and an extraordinary person to follow, who, of course, you know intimately from having worked with her. I'm wondering how you are imagining your own tenure, acknowledging that you can't know everything that will come in front of you. But what are some of the lessons you will take from the Ifill era, and what are some things you're imagining building on?
Yeah, Sherrilyn has been such an amazing leader, and it's been just an incredible journey to be with her for the past 8 years, helping to build LDF's profile and make it even stronger than when we encountered it, and certainly than when she encountered it a year before I got there. I'm excited because I don't need to transform this institution with such a storied legacy, but I have an amazing foundation on which to build. There's so much work ahead of us. There are so many challenges, and we have a formidable and growing team of advocates and staff ranging from researchers to organizers to policymakers to help us lift this heavy load. And it's going to be, I think, a very critical period for the Legal Defense Fund, because it is a critical period for our democracy. There are a lot of challenges ahead for us, and that's what we're, honing our skills and tools to face.
You know, as you talk about the challenges facing our democracy in this moment, the question of education and of an understanding of our history is a core challenge we're currently facing.
Absolutely. We are in the midst of a serious battle that is a fight for the soul of this country. And it centers around our ability to hear, access, and absorb the truth. We are seeing so many laws proliferate across the country that aim to keep the truth of our history, the truth of our current conditions, away from the next generation of residents of this country. And it is something that is core to civil rights work, even if it's not obvious on the face of it. If we can't tell our truth, if we can't make a claim for justice, then we really have no ability to advocate for the advancement of our society, for equitable policies, for the change that we need to really live up to our constitutional ideals. So this battle for truth is at the center of the fight for our future.
Now, you talk about it as a battle for truth. This has been framed in so many state legislatures as being about critical race theory, which I got to say, even in the most progressive districts, I can't imagine critical race theory, which was, of course, developed in law school education, being taught at a K-12 level. But what is it that is, let's take out that language of critical race theory, which actually designates something very specific, and talk about what is embattled here. When you say truth, what do you mean?
What I mean is an honest conversation about the origins of this country, which we know were founded on the subjugation of not just Black people, but also Indigenous persons. And our country has gone through many iterations in which it has discriminated against various groups of people who have immigrated to this country in different ways. And a recognition of how we came to be the incredibly diverse nation that we are is something that we should embrace. We should celebrate the evolution of our country from one that was founded on enslavement to one that now has the potential to be the most ambitious democratic experiment I think this planet has ever witnessed, if we would let it be. And that is really what the concern is to try to stifle the reality of our history and how it manifests in inequities today. And that's because it really brings attention to the power structure that is in place right now, and it causes people to question why certain systems exist in a way that continue to perpetuate discrimination. And I think it's a direct backlash to the thirst for knowledge and the appetite that was unleashed last year when we saw protests across the country around police violence, where citizens from different backgrounds and ethnicities and generations came together and began to have a collective understanding about discrimination and inequality in our society. And that caused some people to become very nervous and very scared, and therefore to try to suppress the truth about our history and the path forward.
I'm wondering about the ways that the history of LDF included really indicating the rights of students, of young people, of individuals to access equal opportunities for education, whether at the earliest levels all the way up through college and graduate school. And it seems like that typically law, at least, right, sort of that jurisprudence has focused on the rights of people to access these ideas. And I'm wondering, kind of flipping that, right, the rights to ensure that these ideas are in the public sphere in order to be accessed.
That's right. I mean, we've done work around access to education throughout our history, and obviously the most well-known case in that area is Brown versus Board of Education, which ended state-sponsored segregation in public schools. And the right to access information, the right to information, is something that the Supreme Court has recognized. It's something that really is foundational to our Constitution and our core principles of freedom of expression and freedom of thought. And this is something that we've also celebrated in our affirmative action work when we talk about the need for diversity in higher education, for there to be an exchange of ideas, for there to be a diverse class of persons learning together who can inform one another's perspectives. We know that that produces the best and highest performing society, the best, most productive workplaces. We know that our diversity is our strength. And what we're seeing in this current iteration of whitewashing and of an effort to suppress the truth is a stifling of that diversity. We're seeing an effort to ignore what I think is one of the most profound stories of transformation and evolution that can propel us forward.
Typically, When we think also about the foundational rights of democracy, voting is there at the core, right? This is how we know kind of the health of our democracy. Are these two things connected in any way?
Absolutely. I think that what we're seeing is a effort on at least three fronts to silence the majority of persons in this country from exercising their voice and being heard and effecting change that reflects their conditions. We're seeing an assault on the right to vote. We're seeing an assault on the right to protest. And we are also experiencing what we've been talking about, and that is an assault on truth. And all three of those work to silence the emerging majority of people of color in this country. And that is a very, very dangerous circumstance. It is laying a foundation and paving a way for minoritarian rule, for very anti-democratic and authoritarian regimes to take root. And it is a significant barrier to our ability to realize the promise of this country, to realize the promise of this multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy.
Let's talk a little bit more about voting rights. Clearly, despite many calls for and legislative possibilities and options, the U.S. Congress was unable, at least at this point, to pass meaningful voting rights legislation. We now have new maps drawn in many states across there's new maps in nearly every state across the country, and some are undoubtedly going to come up for challenge, maybe particularly Texas and Georgia. I'm wondering how you're feeling about our current realities around voting, particularly going into the midterm elections.
Well, I'm deeply concerned. We are in dire need of federal legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which in my mind marks the first year that we became a real democracy. It was the first year in our history where all Americans were enabled to vote. And what we're seeing now is a Congress that has failed the American people, that has used the filibuster as a barrier to progress, to inclusion, to the expansion of the electorate that is absolutely necessary to make sure that we are reflecting the interests and the viewpoints of the majority of Americans who live in this country. What the Supreme Court said back in 1886 in a case called Yickwo versus Hopkins is as true today as it was then, and that is that the right to vote is preservative of all rights. If we don't have the right to vote, there's no way to protect and secure the other rights that we enjoy. And so this fight for the right to vote, this fight for federal legislation that will protect against partisan gerrymandering, that will protect against the manipulation of who gets to vote at the polls, that will ensure that basic principles like early voting are uniform. That fight is really critical to our ability to maintain this young democracy that we have. And we need two pieces of legislation to get us there, and that's the Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. And those are now currently being stalled in Congress.
Given the stall at the federal level around legislation, given the challenges of the Supreme Court, is there hope in the states? Which seems almost an odd thing to ask the NAACP LDF, but I'm wondering if there are strategies that are state-based, given sort of the realities of the filibuster and, again, of the conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
You know, it is a bit ironic that we're looking to states for some relief in this area, but it is an area of great possibility. There are states that have enacted their own voting rights acts, and it is something that we are advocating for in every state. We think it's critically important that there not only be federal legislation, but that there is also laws and protections at the state and local levels that expand voting access. The Constitution gives states very broad authority to determine the qualifications of the electorate. And there are ways that states can make their laws even more expansive than what we currently see at the federal level. So that is another avenue of advocacy. And while we're waiting for Congress to do its job and reflect the will of a majority of Americans, we can also be pushing states that are amenable to also enact legislation that will expand our democracy.
Janae Nelson is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and soon President. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Melissa. It was my pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.